Facebook connects people, and they know meaningful connection can only happen on safe, secure platforms. That's why they've invested $16 billion in safety over 6 years. The impact? They've quadrupled their safety and security teams and addressed millions of pieces of harmful content and removed 1.7 billion fake accounts over the last few months. Learn more about how they protect their communities online and the work ahead at about.fb.com/taking action.
It was making an incredible noise. It was making a noise like a jet engine. And the guy said to me, what do you even call that? I said, I don't know. I said, it's some sort of fire vortex. And it wasn't until later that I even realized that it was a thing, that there were these things that, you know, were basically fire-nados or fire-tornadoes.
Hi, I'm Jan Renner, founder of Roaring Earth.
And I'm science journalist Kate Morgan.
In each episode of the Roaring Earth podcast, we explore mysteries of the natural world, delving into the science behind amazing wildlife behavior and wild phenomena captured on video by people like you.
We started with Chris Tangi narrating footage he captured in Australia back in 2012.
As he and his film crew scoped out a location in a recently burned section of the outback, the flames flickered back to life, and the conditions were perfect to create something truly epic. A 100-foot-tall vortex of swirling smoke and flames. A fire tornado.
The video footage made headlines around the world, and the Roaring Earth audience went crazy with comments and questions. We asked Kate to unravel the mysteries of fire tornadoes, so she put leading experts in the hot seat to help explain this stunning phenomenon, which seems like something straight out of a disaster movie.
The Earth is always burning. The cycle has gone on and on for millennia. Lightning sparks fire, which rips across the forest or the plains or even the desert, burning up old plants and underbrush to make way for the new. From the singed ground, fresh life emerges, and the story starts again. The relationship between man and fire is also a tale as old as time. Across cultures, geography, and religions, our most ancient creation myths all involve a flame. But somewhere along the way, our bond with fire shifted. We sought to control it. Fire helped us build civilizations, kept us warm, cooked our meals, forged our tools. But man began to see wildfire as a threat. We didn't want it near our homes. We didn't want it in our fields, and we didn't want it in our trees. Suddenly, wildfire wasn't a necessary agent of change. It was an agent of destruction. For the last couple of centuries, controlling it has meant dousing every last spark. But when it comes to the forces of our planet, there are some things that are just way, way beyond our control. We haven't tamed wildfire any more than we've tamed the weather. But that's because, well, fire and weather, they're two sides of the same pretty extreme coin. We'll get to the fire tornado thing, I promise. But first, you need to understand fire weather.
We have different weather conditions that are inducive of large fires and helps maybe a smaller fire become a bigger, more sustained extreme fire.
That's Amanda Cunningham. She's a fire weather meteorologist. Oh yes, that is a thing. And it's her job to predict the unpredictable. How a fire will behave based on the weather that's coming its way. You may be surprised to learn that a wildfire's first response team often includes the weather girl.
You're there on site, you have your laptops, you're kind of tucked away in your corner looking at all your weather data. You can watch satellite imagery and you can see a lot of clues. We kind of say we're almost a little like detectives where you're watching radar, you're looking for boundaries and kind of anything that might catch firefighters off guard of changing weather conditions.
When you're deep in a rugged wilderness, surrounded by a fire burning at more than 1,000 degrees, being caught off guard by anything is not ideal.
We always say that when you're a meteorologist on site, of a wildfire, your main role is so that there are no surprises.
Sudden changes in the weather are what can take a wildfire from routine to extremely dangerous and even deadly. Some of the worst disasters in wildfire history, and the ones that claimed the most lives, happened because the wind shifted.
This is the one time in my life when I was actually on a fire as a firefighter where something happened to me and I said, holy cow, this is how firefighters die.
Jason Forthover is a mechanical engineer with the U.S. Forest Service at a place in Montana called the Missoula Fire Sciences Laboratory. And this year was his 25th firefighting season. About 4 years ago, he was fighting a fire not far from Missoula. It had spread to about 30,000 pretty remote acres, and Jason and his team thought they'd cleared all the nearby cabins.
And then we heard a kind of a rumor, basically, of this other cabin that turned out to be, you know, that was like farther in the woods.
There they are in the middle of nowhere, half a mile from the road and the safety of their truck.
We're in the middle of just a thick forest in the bottom of a big drainage, which is kind of a dangerous place to be if a fire is really moving. And all of a sudden, I heard a lightning strike. I heard thunder very close to me, and that sent shivers down my spine.
Jason hadn't known there were thunderstorms in the area, but he knew what could happen if one started while he was still in the vicinity of the fire. Welcome to Weather 101. All over the planet, all of the time, invisible currents are moving air around. It's a pretty complex science, but there are two basic rules. Number one, heat rises. Warm columns of air, called updrafts, move skyward, carrying moisture that creates cumulus clouds, then pushing them higher and higher, turning them to cumulonimbus, or storm clouds. And rule number two, what goes up must come down. That moisture starts to fall from the cloud as rain, and the air beneath the storm is abruptly cooled, forming a cold downdraft. When falling cold air takes the place of rising warm air, the line where they meet is called a front. And as that front spreads along the ground, it creates violent gusts of wind.
Sure enough, wind got really strong, like strong enough, like the trees seemed like they were about to blow down in places. And I was running basically back to my vehicle, to the road, to get out to safety. And luckily made it out. But if things had been just a little different, it really scared me.
What had him so scared was the potential for the fire to go on a run. With the wind pushing extra oxygen into the blaze, it could easily have flared up and whipped through the forest in a wall of flames, moving a lot faster than Jason and his team. It certainly happened before. On June 30th, 2013, 19 members of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, basically the elite special forces of the firefighting world, were killed by the Yarnell Hill Fire near Prescott, Arizona.
That fire behavior that ended up overrunning those firefighters was caused by thunderstorm outflow winds. So yeah, definitely this kind of thing happens, and it happens more often than I think the public realizes.
It's an intricate dance between weather and fire, but weather isn't always the one leading. Because while weather does influence the behavior of fire, the reverse is also true. As Amanda explains, fires, if they're big enough and hot enough, can change the weather.
Fire itself may be burning so hot and extreme that it creates its own weather. We have fires that create their own thunderstorms and lightning and tornadoes.
To repeat what we've learned, weather is the result of hot and cold air moving around. And a wildfire creates a whole lot of hot air. As trees and vegetation burn, the moisture inside them is pushed upwards with that hot air.
In the large fires, you'll actually see a cloud that's not smoke. It's an actual cloud, and it's called a pyrocumulonimbus.
Basically, the fire is capable of creating its very own thunderstorm. And the more intense the fire, the more intense the weather it creates. Which brings us back, finally, to fire tornadoes. Or, as Chris Tangi called what he captured in Australia, a fire-nado.
I was full of awe, just standing there going, wow, what on earth is that? My God, that is incredible, whatever it is. There's an incredible amount of potential power just sitting there in nature that we don't even comprehend or understand until something happens.
When that power's in the form of a thunderstorm, it creates fast, rising updrafts, moving at 100 miles an hour.
It's an intense amount of energy. And then, as physics goes, what goes up must come down.
This creates a swirling, spinning vortex of hot and cold air moving faster and faster as the storm rages on, turning into a funnel that sucks even more hot air off the fire. The funnel gets longer and longer, stretching toward the ground, and when it touches down, it's a full-blown fire tornado, moving across the ground at more than 100 miles an hour, absolutely blowing apart everything in its path. Jason Forthover began researching the phenomenon after seeing the aftermath of a fire tornado in Monterey County, California.
I looked back in history, like, do these things occur? Is this like the first it's ever happened or what? And surprisingly, I found that they're more common than we might think. Tokyo, Japan in 1921, they had a 7.9 magnitude earthquake. It caused a massive urban fire in the city, and a major fire tornado formed around them. The claim is that it killed 38,000 people in 15 minutes.
That's the entire population of Atlantic City, New Jersey, gone in 15 minutes. There are other historic accounts of fire tornadoes too, but they weren't all the result of natural causes. During the World War II bombings of Dresden, Hiroshima, and Hamburg, fire tornadoes raced through parts of the cities.
The Hamburg, Germany fire tornado was said to be 1.5 miles in diameter and 3 miles tall, approximately.
In researching these fire tornadoes of the past, Jason was looking for a lot more than a history lesson. He was trying to understand the extreme fire behavior he was suddenly seeing much closer to home, and working to answer some pretty startling questions. Are fire tornadoes getting bigger, moving faster, becoming more common? And how can the firefighters of the American West, or anyone, battle a force of nature that extreme? Some answers when we come back.
Before the break, we learned about the intense, explosive relationship between fire and weather. Storms can make fires unpredictable and fan the flames until they overrun the people trying to battle them. But when fires create their own storms, things get even more extreme. Under the right conditions, a fire burning hot enough can create a huge, twisting, flaming vortex. And how do you fight a tornado? Back to Kate's report.
On the afternoon of June 11th, 2008, a massive 5,000-acre fire was burning in California's Los Padres National Forest. The firefighting plan for the blaze, known as the Indians Fire, was simple. Teams would move along a road on the western edge of the fire, burning brush and creating breaks, bare stretches of ground, to stop the spread. The weather changed so fast, they didn't know a 1,000-foot-wide fire tornado was coming until it was almost on top of them. Later, survivors would say that trying to get to safety felt like running in chest-deep water.
So we're talking winds in the range of probably 80 to 100 miles an hour. So this thing was pretty massive and lasted for just over an hour. So it's not like it spins up real quick and then goes away. The tornado basically blew right over this fire engine. That was a very lucky situation because they just happened to be on basically like a two-lane paved highway when they were overrun by that tornado. If things would have been slightly different, they may have been like 50 yards off the road. think they all would have died.
They deployed their fire shelters, personal-sized tents made of aluminum foil, silica, and fiberglass that are a firefighter's last resort. Most of them were treated for burn injuries, but everyone made it out. When Jason, working for the Forest Service as an accident investigator, arrived on the scene, he couldn't believe they'd survived. The tornado and the Indians fire was a harbinger of things to come. A decade later, in 2018, Jason would be called nearly 500 miles north to Redding, California, and the scene of another, much more deadly inferno. And this time, he knew exactly what he was looking at.
It was called the Carr Fire. That was a massive fire tornado. The wind speeds would have been in the range of 136 to 165 miles an hour. Everywhere you walked in that area in the aftermath of that thing, the damage and stuff was just like jaw-dropping. It just seemed like I was walking around in some other world. I mean, really, it was like you're in the aftermath of some, you know, major war or something.
Entire blocks of homes were reduced to sticks. The trees that were still standing were perfectly smooth, with all their bark sandblasted off. Three huge steel power line towers had been torn from their concrete bases and lay in twisted piles 1,000 feet away.
There was a big marine shipping container that was lofted into the air and blown a good distance, a few hundred yards. This huge metal structure that's not at all very aerodynamic.
When the tornado hit, two vehicles driven by state fire personnel were pummeled by flying branches and debris. Three bulldozers had their windows blown out. A retired police officer driving away from the scene realized the bed of his truck was on fire and pulled over. He survived, but not without serious burn injuries. The twisting vortex moved through the neighborhood and claimed the lives of 70-year-old Melody Bledsoe and her two great-grandchildren.
And it killed a firefighter from the Redding Fire Department named Jeremy Stoke. The winds were so strong that his vehicle was blown, rolled across the ground. I want to say it was 100 to 150 yards. His truck was rolled across the ground, and he died inside there from blunt force trauma.
Jason and other fire scientists have been working to figure out exactly what happened in Redding that day. How did the Carr Fire ignite a fire tornado with that much sheer destructive power? They think it was something called a hydraulic jump. Imagine a big dam with water rushing down its spillway. At the bottom, where it hits the standing pool, the water curls back in on itself, forming a wave called a hydraulic. Jason thinks the same thing was happening that day, only with air currents. Cold air off the ocean was moving in from the west, and when it hit the mountains outside Redding, it kind of slid down the backside, creating a hydraulic wave in the valley below.
That happened just when the fire had run to that area and was very intense. And so in those standing wave areas, you get tons of vorticity, tons of rotating air. We believe that that fed the rotating air into what became that massive damaging fire tornado.
But all of that is just a hypothesis, a working theory. And that's because in the grand scheme of things, the science of fire weather is really new. Extreme fire experts like Jason and meteorologists like Amanda are only just starting to figure out how to predict things like fire tornadoes. Just a few months ago, in August of 2020, the National Weather Service issued its first ever fire tornado warning. And it almost certainly won't be the last. There's a good chance that future fire seasons may come with more fire tornadoes. Like, a lot more. Fire tornadoes used to be a rare, once-in-a-career occurrence. But wildfires are getting more and more extreme. We're having more of them, and they're not all sparked by lightning. They're started by campfires, tossed cigarettes, electrical malfunctions, gender reveal parties. In other words, by people. Climate change plays a role too, of course. Less precipitation, hotter temperatures, and faster melting snowpacks mean drier seasons are much longer. In California, the window for wildfire is 75 days longer than it used to be. The U.S. Forest Service has changed the way they talk about wildfire. It's not a season anymore. It's an all-year event.
We're having more fires than we did 50 years ago. Certainly, we're burning more acreage per year on average. We're seeing more extreme fire behavior, so fire spreading faster, bigger flames, things like that.
And it's not just happening in the United States. In Sweden, the annual fire season is now 41% longer than it used to be. In Norway, it's up by 288%. In 2017 alone, fires in Europe burned an area three times the size of Siberia. And last year in Australia, not far from where Chris Tangi captured the fire tornado footage that sent this episode spinning, tens of millions of burning acres created a smoke plume the size of the entire United States.
So the natural question, of course, would be, why is that happening? There have been massive changes in the vegetation, you know, everywhere almost.
Invasive and non-native species can drastically alter the way a landscape burns, and our forests and prairies are full of them. Timber companies have planted huge tracts in California with oily, highly flammable Australian eucalyptus trees. Cheatgrass, a quick-growing Eurasian species accidentally imported in the 1800s as packing material, now covers more than 12 million acres across 49 states, and it burns like crazy. Invasive people have contributed to the problem, too. Remember that cycle of fires burning away the old and dead to make way for new growth? Native people encouraged it with controlled burns, but those traditions and the cycle were interrupted. As settlers moved into the American West, the philosophy of wildfire management became basically put it all out. And now we've got a landscape loaded with way too much fuel.
Now, if we put out all these fires like we've been doing for the last, say, 100 years or so, and a fire starts under conditions that we can't put it out, it's just got that much more fuel, tons more fuel to burn, and it spreads, you know, more rapidly, more intense, bigger flames, much more difficult to suppress.
Thanks to all of this, more drought, higher temperatures, and overgrown landscapes, wildfires are intensifying. In the 2020s, we could see the most extreme fires in modern history. And with extreme fires come extreme weather events, like fire tornadoes. We'll have a tough time controlling these blazes, but while we can't beat them, we can outthink them. The science of fire meteorology is growing at breakneck speed, and events like the fire tornadoes on the Indians and car fires have taught management agencies around the world the volatility of our planet's weather and how vital it is to see these things coming. For the last few years, Amanda Cunningham has been traveling the globe, training firefighters to see invisible air currents and to predict what they'll do next.
I recognized that there was this need for training, that there was a lot of people in the fire world who are being forced to make these really big critical decisions, and that the weather is almost like this mysterious unknown. Oh, we just have to go with it. Unexpected weather, unexpected front, unexpected storm. And as a meteorologist, I was like, no, it wasn't unexpected. We just didn't understand why it was happening or that it was coming.
When he's not fighting fires, Jason and his colleagues at the Fire Sciences Laboratory in Missoula, Montana, work to unravel the mysteries of fire behavior.
We have a big wind tunnel and also basically a giant room that we call a burn chamber. And since about 1960, we've been doing wildland fire research.
Based on the immense amount of data they've gathered, the team recently launched a program called Wind Ninja, which is designed to model how wind and fire will move around complex terrain.
We made a phone app, so actually the people on the ground doing the firefighting can do a simulation on their phone and view the outputs over, say, the next 12 or 18 hours of the winds in their exact location.
Amanda's training and Jason's tools are all steps toward a larger goal, a future where humans and fire live in harmony.
In a lot of places, fire is basically inevitable. It's not a question of if it will happen, it's when it will happen. We need to live with fire. that's how most of us as fire scientists view our role. And hopefully through better understanding, we can develop a better way to live with fire.
It's not about control. It's about management. After all, we don't expect to control the weather. But the more we understand fire and its behavior, the easier it'll be to return to a time when we lived together in the world. Fire and man, locked in the infinite cycle of life.
I'm so blown away, pun totally intended, by the colossal power of fire to reshape the planet, take life, create life, and even control the weather. Thanks for listening to the Roaring Earth Podcast. If you liked our show, please follow us on your favorite podcast app and share with your friends. Comments and reviews are always greatly appreciated. For more info on today's episode, including videos and research, visit roaringearth.com. On our next episode, you may think otters are super cute, but as you'll learn, they're actually vicious super predators. In South America, a team of scientists and a pair of giant otters are working to restore their species. It'll change the way you think about conservation and everything you thought you knew about otters. Until then, send us your amazing wildlife and nature videos so we can delve deep into the story behind them. The Roaring Earth Podcast was written and produced by Kate Morgan. Sound engineering and original music was provided by Joe Baseri. Casey O'Brien is the associate producer. Jan Renner and Glenn Hoffman are the executive producers. Special thanks to Chris Tangi, Amanda Cunningham, Jason Forthoffer, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Missoula Fire Sciences Laboratory. I'm Jan Renner for Roaring Earth.